We gather with give everybody a chance to gather in. Let me just take this opportunity for quick feedback, since I don't want to take up too much of a time once you really get started. But any comments as to how? Yeah.
Shala is no longer wearing diapers to bed.
Fantastic. How about that? Worth it just for that. One kid out of diapers. So did you go through the process? What did you do?
Well, we
just put a catheter in.
he thought we would first just like wait till she went. The first night I said okay when she falls asleep, I'll like later when I was about to put my diaper on her. But when I went to put on the diaper on her, she woke up and she said no. So I said okay. I said I took her to the bathroom, and she woke up dry the next morning. So we just kept on.
Fantastic.
Yay.
That is an achievement.
Maya lets me brush her teeth.
Excellent. And used to be a struggle, I imagine.
She used to say, but I did it such a good job. She wouldn't let you do it. She's like, I did everywhere. And she'd show me. Wouldn't let me touch it.
Okay, good. Happy that there's a feeling of some level moving forward. This will be a wonderful tool. I have heard from a bunch of different people. I'm just asking around as I see people over the course of the week how things are going. So I know it's hard to remember people that we often fall back into our old habits. We had a couple here for Shabbos and as they were leaving. So at the end of a meal, kids already at their wit's end. So they're trying to get the stroller out, and the four-year-old like takes off back towards the playroom. And we're standing, the four of us, right? My wife and I and this couple right at the doorway. And in front of us, the husband says, "You don't get yourself out here in the next 10 seconds." And so we're looking like, then what? Like, how are you going to finish that? Once you throw a spell like that,
you're leaving
me all shaved up. So Rifki says, "I'll tell you what, if you don't get in 10 seconds, you're going to be the example next Monday night." That's just a natural, we just run back into the threats, into the warnings, into all the things that don't naturally work. And the last 2 weeks you've been speaking, really just a brief introduction. It's an entire process. It's a theory. I encourage everybody to get the books. There's a woman named Becky Udman. She's a Rebbetzin in Dallas, who I've mentioned to a couple of people. Also, you can Google her. You'll find it. And she is an expert in love and logic and lectures. Although, she was actually here. She came to Third Day School to speak maybe a year or so ago.
She came like...
No, she came like
2 years ago. She was here.
3 miles, I think, too.
So I've listened to a series that she has, like a four-part series. She is a wonderful presenter. She's got it down pat. She's got great stories. And if it's a process, a concept, this love and logic that you feel works on some level, so I encourage you to listen to her tapes, buy the book themselves, Love and Logic. They have Love and Logic for parents, for teenagers for marriage. They do it. They ran it through the gamut of the process. But anyway, so I hope that's been successful, and we will continue with that. Okay, before we move into tonight, I just wanted to share a funny thing that happened to me tonight. When you go on an airplane, everybody knows your routine already by heart. You know, they do the whole thing with buckling your seatbelt, and if you lose pressure, so the air masks will drop from above. And everyone knows, they always say put on your own before taking care of your child. And the obvious reason for that is because if you run out of oxygen, you're not going to be much help for your child. Your child will be okay. Take care of yourself first. And then go deal with your child. So tonight I came home. Rifki ran out at 5:30, leaving me with the 5 children to feed and bathe. So I can handle it. We're going to manage. But the problem is, coming home at 5:30, I was pretty hungry myself. And as I walked into this scene, so one of the Ephraim had a friend over. They're playing volleyball in here. They set up the chairs, and everyone's running all this. And it's going to take a lot of energy to really deal with the supper scene. So it occurred to me, forget them. I went and got myself supper, a whole plate, sat down to a quiet meal by myself in the kitchen because everybody else was playing around. And then afterwards, tackled the supper scene. And it's a lesson that we all know, but we very often forget about, that when we're exhausted or hungry, or you have to go to the bathroom, or whatever it is that our children don't allow us to do, we're really in a very poor place to handle that which we need to do. And it's often a great little thing. And then, you know, you deal with that, and then you sit down, and I can sit with them, and then it's not a problem, but I have to be up 3 times. So this one needs water, and this one needs a second serving of this, and this one needed that. And the baby's running around, and you could be present at whatever's going on, because I don't have to worry about eating myself also. So it just occurred to me that sometimes it's a nice approach to remind ourselves. We all know that, but don't forget it when those moments of hunger pangs happen. You got to take care of yourself. You won't be able to deal with the stresses of our children. Okay. So the next two phases, the next two sessions are based on these two books. Between Parent and Child is by Chaim Ginat. Chaim Ginat in his official thing. And How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk by Faber and Maslisch. They are students of his. They quote him. They say that they got everything from his sessions that he used to give. This is just a more modern adaptation. This was probably written 30 or 40 years ago. This was written 10 to 20 years ago. Just a more modern adaptation. These are two wonderful books. They're very easy reads. I have some handouts, photocopies of these books to share that these are from. This is a very different approach than the Love and Logic. Love and Logic was a very behavioral-based approach. Child does this, no problem, you suffer the consequences, you deal with it, I'm going to stay calm, you're just going to handle the ramifications of your own actions. It's very behaviorally based, and those of you who felt that's a little bit harsh, it sometimes is. They say it's loving, but I haven't found it. It's a great approach for crisis situation. How do I handle it? I have an approach. This is what we're going to do. I'm not going to stress over crushing tea time anymore. I know how I'm going to handle this. So their approach is very different. Totally different approach, and I love how the two go together. They're much more about communication and creating the atmosphere in the home that we really want to have. The atmosphere, the lack of the tension, without the stress, without the yelling, without the screaming. That atmosphere, so that's what this is going to be. And I'd like to share, tonight we'll start with maybe three different techniques and skills that we could work on. So the post to Love and Logic, and this will be my last little introduction and we'll get started. Love and Logic, if you hadn't heard it before, like everything was new. It was like a whole approach of like, oh, I never thought about doing it this way or that way. And then you get used to it and you try to adjust. These things that we'll talk about, you're all familiar with. I very much include myself, don't do them very well. So you might be a little bit familiar with them, but the review is great, and hopefully we'll learn a lot of new phrases, skills, techniques as we go along. Okay, let's start with the 80-20 rule, which I hope you all have heard. I first came across this maybe 2 or 3 years ago. It was news to me. 80-20 rule is, I've seen it in a couple separate sources subsequent to the first place that I saw it. When we think about our interactions with our children, so 80% of them should be positive from the child's perspective. That if you were the child going through this interaction and we were to freeze the frame and say, stop right there. This experience for you right now, little boy, little girl, is a fuzzy, warm one, an enjoyable experience, or this is one filled with tension and hatred and you want to run. So if we could get into the child's world, 80% of our interactions should be positive, should be where the child feels a good sense, a positive sense, something warm about it. And then 20 are those instances where either we fail as parents and we just say the wrong things, do the wrong things, or we lose it, or we need to somehow give some form of instruction, criticism, something which the child would not necessarily see as pleasant. When I first saw those numbers, I thought, that's 20%. Like, I'm much better than that for sure. 80-20, I'm much higher than 80%. In my home, total warmth and love and giving and caring. And the first time that I stopped to pay attention, it is the exact opposite. Yeah?
So is that 80% of all interactions or 80%? Is there a neutral category?
So I have found there to be a neutral category. Most of the things that I want to deal with tonight are really taking the things which we generally push into negative interactions and at least move them into neutral. Love and Logic, for example, does a lot of that, in which we take what would otherwise be a very stressful situation of brushing teeth, just as our classic example, which can be a very negative, stressful experience, and it just makes it into very neutral. Time to brush your teeth. I'm just going to stand it for a few minutes. If you come, great. If not, no. It's not a positive experience, but it takes what can potentially be very negative and sort of neutralize it.
So that is the 80% of the non-neutral.
So, I'm not going to play with the numbers. You know, the medical world, just don't get caught up on the numbers. I don't know exactly, but there's a thought behind that of a general atmosphere of positive feeling, of warm interactions with our children, that if you stop and notice and count the way that we speak, we're very often just filled with directives. Do this, don't do that, get in the car, buckle up, clean up your breakfast, finish tying your shoes. It's just one long directive after another directive. A lot of negative. You did this wrong. It's a lot of not such pleasant types of interactions that we have. Now, the approach that they take is that we need to really appreciate the power of our words, the way that we speak, the ability of our words to have an impact. And one of the greatest lies that we all grew up with is the famous nursery rhyme of sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never harm me. We all know that's not true. Experience has taught us words are one of the most powerful tools. The effects that it leaves on us when we are the butt end of a harsh comment or criticism can stay with us for years. The impact that people who speak in inappropriate ways, those who put us down, give us negative feedback, they're very, very powerful. And we have that tremendous ability with our children. Okay, now pick on Dan. Let's just say Dan used to come to our house a lot before he was married. So one time, part of the story is true, part of the story is not true. You could figure out which part. One time, Dan forgot his umbrella as he was walking out. So I ran after him and I said, Dan, every single time you come, you forget something. If it's not one thing, it's another. How many times did I tell you, before you leave, don't forget to check to make sure you have your umbrella? You know, your younger sister, she is so amazing. When she comes here, she's so pleasant to be around. She doesn't cause any of these troubles. You're almost 30 years old already. Like, when are you going to learn? If it wouldn't... Sorry. Maybe you're lucky if you get to be on 40. So part of that story is true, part of that story is not true. We actually talk that way to our children, even though we would never talk that way to a guest. When a guest forgets an umbrella, how do we give it back to them? Here, you forgot your umbrella. And we don't add scatterbrain. Right, we just state the facts. Yet when it's our children forgetting their lunch, it somehow gives us license to express all sorts of things about their inability to remember and how many times have I told you and when are you ever going to learn and when are you going to grow up and this one ever does that. And the words that we use, we can create a sort of an impression within the child if they grow up with that enough that they're actually not really capable of doing certain things because they're constantly hearing in our homes how they're forgetful, they didn't do this and they didn't do that right. Child who gets dressed on their own and comes into the kitchen but forgot to put his shoes on. Right, did a great job, but he's got to put his shoes on. How we respond to that, we could either say it in a way of, fantastic, look, you got dressed up by yourself. You just need to put on your shoes and you'll be all ready to go. Versus, you still didn't put your shoes on, when are you going to have to leave? It's a totally different approach as to what the child gets, in which both situations you could let the child know he's missing something or she's missing something, but they leave with a totally different sense of themselves as far as they go. Okay, so I wanted to do three things tonight as we learn about the power of our words. Let's take the first one, I think the simplest one, and that is eliminating the word no from our vocabulary at home. Now, this is quite a task because children ask thousands of questions. As I was thinking about this, I took two of my kids to the store on Friday. After I picked them up from school, we went to Kroger, Publix. I needed, I think, three things. I was in the store probably for 5 minutes. So you include driving from Beth Jacob, I picked them up, then to Publix, and back. And I was just taking a list. This is what we got. We had, as soon as we pulled in, we passed Brewster. So we got, could we get ice cream? Could we go to the bakery? Can we have the car cart? No, that car. Can we have that car? Can we get a balloon? Can I pick out the flowers? Can I do the self-checkout? Can I get a drink? Can I get a bagel? Can we go home now? It's just a constant barrage of questions. And the answer to almost all of those is actually
no.
No, we can't go to ice cream, and we can't go to the bakery, and we can't get a bagel, and you're not going to get a balloon, and then you can't get this drink, and you can't get that snack, and we're not going to go to Target, and no, we can't go home right now because I need to go to the cleaners first. So the answer is generally, to most of these things, no, for perfectly valid reasons. Now, how we're going to communicate this is going to be a totally different story. So now the first thing that I want to point out, before we even get to that, is to recognize the time pressures that we're under and how that affects us. We often don't take that for granted in building. Just as an example, when we had Binyamin, our second child, so I had been at that point in my life, I was really good about getting to Minyan on time, right? Until Binyamin. I would be there 3 minutes early every morning. Shachris would come. You could count on me like clockwork. I was 3 minutes early. Right after Binyamin was born, I started coming about 3 to 5 minutes late every single morning, exactly the same time. 3 to 5 minutes late every morning without fail. And the same thing would happen every single morning. Now there are two kids. Somebody was always up, and somebody always needed a bottle or a diaper before I left the house. Every morning. And for about 3 months, I would drive to shul with the same thought going through my mind. I can't believe I'm going to be late again because I needed to take care of diaper, bottle, throw up, whatever, you name it. But it always happened. And every single morning I was walking to shul late with the same excuse in my mind of, again, they needed something. If only the kids wouldn't be up, if they would just wake up 20 minutes later, I can get out of the house first, I would be on time.
Your wife's problem.
Yes, that's the marriage. That's the marriage workshop. We're not here right now. So, and it finally occurred to me, the most obvious thought, which you're all probably thinking right now, it says, well, when you have two children, you actually need to wake up 5 minutes earlier if you want to get out of the house at the same time. It's simply the reality of life. It's just different. It wasn't the way that it was where you could wake up whatever time it was, 25 minutes. If the alarm went off 20 minutes, 5 minutes before davening, I would be there 3 minutes before it started. It just doesn't work that way anymore. There's just other time constraints. So that's an obvious example. We sometimes forget that if you take two kids to Publix, it's going to take you 10 minutes longer to get through the store. There is no other way around it. You just can't.
How do you do it in only 10 minutes extra?
Wait till we finish. Wait till we finish all the answers to the questions. Look at it. So I'm saying, but whatever time it is, you have to build that in. And we forget that. And as much as it took me 3 months to recognize that if I don't set the alarm clock 3 minutes or 5 minutes earlier, I will always be 5 minutes late because I have more responsibility. There's other stuff going on in the house. We sometimes think, sure, I could take my kids to and do whatever I need to do, run to the 5 errands that I need to run before Shabbos, think that I'm going to do it in the same amount of time that I used to do it without them, and then amazingly get real frustrated when they want to stop and get a balloon on the way out. Because who has time for that? Because we're running late. Because I was actually expecting to be out of here 5 minutes ago, and we're already running late because you have to do whatever kids need to do when they're in the supermarket. So that's just point A, just... It needs to be stated because we actually take that for granted and thinking that we could do the same tasks as fast as we can do without the kids, as with the kids, it doesn't work. But how do we deal with the no's? So we have all of these no's here. So the trick is replace your answer of no with a yes, giving the child the time, the place, or what they need to do to get what they want. So, for example, when I set out with the kids I now know, I'm willing to purchase them one thing as a treat. That's going to be the... If I'm taking two kids to Publix, they're going to get something. They can go to the ice cream store, they can go to the bakery, they can get something from Publix. I don't care. They're all going to get something. So that when that first... I'm prepared because this is part of the task. I'm prepared. Can we go to the ice cream store? Sure. No problem. First, we're going to go shopping on the way out. Well, 3 minutes later, we pass the bakery. Can we go to the bakery? What's my response? Sure, if you'd rather do that than go to ice cream, no problem. So that the answer is yes, you can't have them both. You can have the ice cream, the bakery, if you'd rather do that after we go shopping. And then I ask them, you guys can choose. Whatever you want to do is totally fine with me. Well, that only lasts until we get to Publix because now they want a bagel. Can we have a bagel? Sure. You can have a bagel. If you'd rather get a bagel, then... So in that circumstance, in that line of thinking, there's a yes here, and you can decide what it is and when it is that you want. I want to run through a bunch of different examples. You just go through it. It takes a little bit of practice and training, but it actually, this is one of the easiest things in which you can adjust the way that you speak. You're running through Target as fast as you can because you have to run around and shop with you and they want to get a... Can I get that toy? Now what's the answer, of course? No, you can't get that toy. But do you ever buy toys for your children?
Yeah.
Sure, when do you get them toys?
Whenever we go out.
For their birthday. No. Wrong answer. For their birthday. For Hanukkah. For Afikoman presents. You name it. There's something there. So instead of saying, right now the answer is no. They want the toy, which they cannot have right now, for whatever reason. Whether that's because it's too expensive, whether that's because you don't have time to get it now, whether that's because you think they have enough toys, and they don't need every single time they say that they want something to get something. Whatever the reason is, the answer right now, in effect, is no. But instead of engaging in the battle in the middle of Target of no, but I want it, no, it's sure, you can get that for your birthday if you'd like. I'm just giving you the time when you can have it, And so you can have it. And you can have the Rafi Coleman. And then you have a responsibility for knowing that's what you'd like. And it's a way of, instead of saying no, it's a matter of saying when you can have it. Inside the house. I kind of have a snack. Can I have chocolate milk? The answer is, well, no, not right now. But yes, after you have your snack. After you have... So now we flip into love and lust. In other words, it would be the answer is you want it now. So, yeah, so I want chocolate milk. After you finish your apple.
But I want it now.
After you finish your apple.
But
so then, right, and that's where the conversation, and then what happens is, if you remember last week, at the very end last week, we spoke about going brain dead when it comes to arguing with your child. Once you've had that conversation, and you said, this is when you can have it, and they can say, I know, you can have it after you eat your apple. It just becomes very repetitive. Children, just like, if ever, like when a child grabs something from another child, like a toy. What if they want the other child to then run after them, and that's the game in which they run after and keep away. If the child who had the toy taken from them doesn't chase after the child, there's like no game anymore, and it's not fun anymore. So usually you give it back because that's not any fun. You're not chasing after me. So it's the same thing when you just engage with this. I know. After you finish your apple, I know. If they then lose it, then it's bringing them into the room, and then you go through that other process, just flipping into that. But the more that we can avoid the word no, which is this very confrontational, what it does is it always will result in the child saying, but I, that's always the response to a no. Or they'll just ask another question or another question. So the more that we can shift into a response of when they can have it, you can have it after supper. Can I have a play date today? Get in the car, finally get them into their car seat. They do a perfect job because they know that they've been love and logic. They know they're going to get into the car seat. And then they ask, well, can I have a play date? Now, love and logic doesn't help you for this circumstance. Like, I don't know, how do I respond to that? Like, the answer is no. So you could say no, and you can engage in this entire battle. So instead of getting in the habit of saying no, it's more valuable if you could say, we can have a play date tomorrow, or we can have a play date on Thursday, Friday, whenever it may be. I missed my story from this. The better we get at presenting the child with what they need to do, especially when the answer is what the child needs to do to get it. When you finish cleaning your room, you can have a snack. So I'm not telling you no. I mean, this is what you need to do in order to be able to get it. Yeah?
How far can you go? I mean, can you, like... When you get a job, you can buy this. I mean, like.
Yeah, I mean, you can try that. Let me know how it goes. It's totally fine. In other words, I would say, in other words, to my 9-year-old already at this point, and even to my 7-year-old, if they said that they wanted a certain toy, and it was an expensive toy that they for sure didn't need, and that I'm not interested in getting them, and they say, can I have this? So I've gotten to the habit now of, instead of saying, no, it's too expensive, sometimes we say that because that happens to be a chinuch. We like giving our children, like, no, there are certain things which are too expensive and you can't have everything that you want. But the other times it's a matter of, sure, you can have that. And then there'll be so much fallible. And the response is, if you want to pay for that, that's totally fine. Would you like to, you know, do whatever it is that you want to do? And if you'd like to work for it, that'd be a great idea for you to get that. I'd love for you to have that. Right, 100%. So I'm not going to say no. That for me, I'm not going to get you that. But if you want it, of course you can have it. You just need to figure out a way to pay for it. Would you like me to help you to think of ways that you can make some money? Things like that. And even a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old, they get that already, that if they want it, they can have it. I'm not going to be the one there telling them no, because from experience, I'm sure you've always, those are just the most meaningless and fruitless conversations where you get into these battles of no, but I want, and it's just... So instead, give them what they need in order to be able to get it. Yeah, sure, you can have it. This is what you need to do in order to get it. Would you like that for your birthday? You can have it.
Can I go back for a second? So I've tried this before, like, no, you know, we can't get this now, but we'll get it or choose one of the two toys or whatever, and we'll get the other one you can get for your birthday or for whatever's coming up next. And then I get but there's only one left, so we have to get it now so that they won't run out. Or there's only two left, and if we don't get it now, I mean, like, and so now he understands you can't get it now. He understands that you're not getting it for now, and now I've got this.
You've given him a choice that he can get it for, like, his birthday or something?
He can get it for his birthday or something like that, but, like, I mean, I'm trying to get out of the store. Like, it's not even, like, a matter at this point of, I mean, it's both. It's that you don't need to get something every time we go out, and I'm not getting it
right now. If you had the extra minute to buy it, I mean, if you're going to buy it, be checking out anyway, it's usually not such a big deal. That would be a great love and logic experience where now you've bought it for him, and now for the next 20 times that he goes to Target and he asks for something, it's, yeah, we already got, would you like me to return that and get this instead?
And he'll say yes, and I don't actually have the time to go return
stuff. So you don't now. You don't now, but between then and his birthday, you're probably entitled to go like most of the other women in this community 50 times a week, so you'll have a chance without the kids to...
It'll sit in my K-Sock kitchen and on the car. Along with the other 14.
All right, so then then it's a matter of being creative, like, in terms of how to handle, or taking the principles. I don't know exactly, knows if he's going to come up with some argument like that, like this is the last one in the store, they're not going to have any left.
Don't worry, honey, mommy will find one. We work online.
Bring it online.
He will never forget anything, and when I don't find it for him, I will hear for 4 years I told him, and that's why I now need to get everything we get everywhere, because it'll run out like they did last time.
Well, they always restock. I mean, there oftentimes, mm-hmm. There's one enough, but there's more in the back. Usually. And there's nothing there. I mean, she gets name tag. You know, you go and ask them, they have one back.
I'm willing to take that too.
With the birthday thing,
yeah.
My daughter now, I've used that. So when she sees things that she wants, she doesn't even ask anymore. She goes, maybe we'll get
it
for my birthday.
Right, and so that's, yeah.
No, we did one time with Dan's suggestion, and she got a certain amount of money for her birthday.
Mm-hmm.
So I took out the money from the bank, I handed it to her, put it in the backpack when we went to the store. We ran around up and down Toys R Us. She showed all the things that she really liked based on price. I would say yes or no, and I had veto power, but... Then we laid out everything in one aisle, and she decided, like, I can have this, but I can't have that. And after she's like, so maybe next time I get money, we could come back and buy that. When I have, like, a little bit more, we'll do this. And she never asked her anything again. Like, she understands. She understood from that.
Right, excellent.
And she paid for it, and she was so happy.
No, that's great.
She's 10 for it.
And you start them young, and they get into the habit. That's a great little tool in which, like, it's not just...
She was so proud when she had the money, too, and
right.
She handed it over.
Now, love and logic, for example. Now, I didn't really talk about this at all, but the love and logic theory is huge into an allowance, because that's all part of the system of, you have certain responsibilities, you get a certain amount of money, and then you get to choose how you want to spend it. And it's very age-appropriate how much money they get, but I didn't get into that so much. But that they are very big, you know, the authors of Love and Logic into a child having an allowance and being responsible. They, like all things, they take it, in my mind, what's to an extreme in terms of they would even have it where it's like lunch money, and if you spend it, you know, you blow it on the baseball game, like you're not eating lunch that week, because everything by them is real. Yes, if the parent, that's what they spoke about. In other words, they actually brought that example in the book, right? What Dan's saying, like if you're at a stage where your child gets lunch money from you as part of their allowance, like if they blow it, you know, good luck. But I'll give you a good breakfast in the morning. But that's it's a harsh approach, but that's, you know, you take it or leave it when you deal with that theory. Yeah.
It's like I see the point of all this, but doesn't a child also have to know a concept of
no,
and even if it's to the extent of because I said so, period. And yeah, we should try to give an explanation, but they need to have enough.
Yes, I'm pretty confident they'll have plenty of opportunities to hear that. I believe there are times in which we'll, you know, they ask hundreds of questions a day, and you'll have plenty of opportunities to lay down the law and say basically no. What this is about is those generally just, this is just a trip to the store, just trying to get through Publix. And I'm just trying to get in and out with that 10-minute limit of extra time that I've allotted, and I have to field 15 yes or no questions while I'm there. What's the easiest way for me to handle that without making this a very stressful experience, so that when we get home, we can actually say, look, we spent time together. Wasn't that nice? As opposed to just everyone being all stressed out at each other, and it just totally defeats the purpose. So, yes, there's a time and a place for that. It's actually important, especially just from a Jewish perspective. And there are rules and regulations, and there are yeses and there are noes, and that's the way that it goes. And we want to set up those limits. I have no fear that they'll have plenty of opportunity for that. This is just to sort of address the non-life and death kind of situations where no, because I said so, just to be able to deal with it in a more pleasant way. Okay, that's just that's one point, which again, I'm happy to hear that many of you have already been working on that. It's an easier thing to get into the habit of doing in terms of it, as opposed to using that word no 1,000 times. If we can knock it down to 50 a day, we'll all be better off and have more productive conversations. Okay, let's move into the topic of praise. Praise is one of the huge topics in both of their books, something which I imagine many of you have heard or dealt with or been implementing these concepts. So if you have, great, this will be a great review. And if not, this the first time I read this, the cover, it just, it's... So I'll open it with a story that, that happened to me, which really brought for me the point home. Yeah, from my role as the assistant rabbi, so I have the privilege of dealing with many people who come here collecting. The one person who was unfortunately really just not altogether. So he had come on a Friday, a couple months back, he'd come on a Friday, and he ended up staying the entire next week and was there the following Shabbos as well. So I had set him up the first Shabbos that he came, he just showed up on a Friday morning, I scrambled around and got him a place to stay, and then he didn't really have a place during the week, somehow found it. I committed myself to getting him a place the following Friday. The whole week goes by, I didn't take care of it, and I was feeling horrible about it Friday morning. I finally took care of it late Friday afternoon, in which I got in contact with somebody. We have a hospitality person, different women have been doing it over my tenure here. The person was in charge at the time, and she finally calls me back at about 3 o'clock. I have a place for him. But now I can't find him. I went to the shul, and he had gone off somewhere. So I didn't know where he was, and I was feeling horribly guilty about it. I didn't take care of it all week. I saw him the whole week. Now he's walking around. It's 3 o'clock on Friday. He doesn't know where he's going. He doesn't have a place. 4:30, she calls me back, that he had called her. I had given her number. He's in the shul now, and he just wants to know how to get to the place that we had set him in. So I felt I was already on the road. So I said, great, I'm out already in the neighborhood running errands. I'll pick him up and take him to his place, feeling so relieved that I found him. He has a place. I should have taken care of this a week ago. I felt that the guy didn't know where he was going until 4:30 on Friday. I'll take care of it. So I tell her, I'll pick him up. Don't worry about it. Now she, not knowing my guilty feelings for having abandoned this poor guy the whole week and setting him up an hour before Shabbos, says to me, Rabbi Freilich, you'll pick him up? These are the words she said. Rabbi Freilich, your chesed knows no limits. Unbelievable. Our community is so blessed to have a person as giving as you. Now how do you think I felt when she said that? But I, like, how did I feel receiving such a wonderful compliment?
Even more guilty.
I felt horrible, right? Totally undeserved. Totally, like, I don't even want to hear that. You don't understand. I, like, abandoned this guy the whole week, an hour before Shabbos, he finds out where he's going. And you're telling me that, like, there's no limit to the chesed that I'm out anyway. And I feel so horrible about the guy. But when I, and so when I heard that, didn't, like, give me any warm feelings whatsoever. It was a tremendously guilty feeling to hear her compliment me on my actions such after what I had been through. Now, yes, that's what they speak about. Praise often seems to have the opposite impact as to what we really want it to have. Somehow the kids, our children, react and we, like, here we are, we praise them, and they suddenly either stop doing the things that they're doing or they go out of their way to misbehave in, on the heels of what we seem to have been, like, very positive comments that we give them. So I think it's in the Faber-Maslach books. There being a couple of examples that I just want to share. Put yourself in the following situation. You're this is more, I guess, for the women. So you have an unexpected guest who shows up in the middle of a week. Your husband calls you 10 minutes before he gets home. Colleague from work coming over. They're having a quick and prompt meeting at the house. Or, you know, can you just put dinner on the table? I wasn't planning on serving dinner tonight. Quickly run into the cab, take out something from a can, leftover chicken, throw it into the stew together, serve it on a bed of rice from a 5-minute Minute Maid, and voila, dinner is served. So your guest, after eating the dinner, you know, thanks you very much and says, you know, you are a fantastic cook that you put this together. What's your reaction inside to hearing him say that?
If you only knew.
Right? If you only knew. And really what you're thinking is, really, this guy really must not have a real good tongue for good quality food. I mean, I threw out canned food, some leftover chicken from Shabbos that I threw into the mix on a 5-minute rice, and he's here saying what a fantastic cook I am. Like, what's he, medical school or something? Where is he? What, like, so I can't really value such a compliment that's coming from somebody who can't possibly really know what he's talking about if this is what he thinks is fantastic food. This will also be just for the women. I just made up this example. Let's just say you spend about 45 minutes getting dressed on Shabbos morning. You have tried on every single thing in your wardrobe. Your entire wardrobe is now out on your bed Shabbos morning. Your room is an entire mess. And you finally found something and you make your way to shul. And someone, a friend of yours, sees you and says, "Wow, you always look so beautifully dressed Shabbos morning." What's your response in time?
You've got to be kidding me.
Right? Either you've got to be kidding me. You could be thinking, you would have seen me a half hour ago. I was still in my pajamas, like my entire wardrobe is out on my... Now, there's another thing that this kind of compliment does when you say something like that. What are you thinking about for next week?
Uh-oh.
Right? Now, I got this tremendous amount of anxiety, and this is a threatening kind of compliment. Someone just told me, "Wow, you always look so beautifully put together on Shabbos." Well, next week I'm going to have the same problem because I'm going to have to go through my entire wardrobe again because there's this expectation of I have to meet. And it actually creates a lot of angst when you get compliments like that, that I need to somehow reproduce that which I'm not really very good at. I don't want to be able to have to live up to that kind of... Now, the other kind of thing that happens with compliments like that, if you're in a class and you raise the question and the colleague student comes over after and says, "Wow, what a brilliant person you are. Or you have such a brilliant mind." So we almost always react to those kind of statements by downplaying that and focusing on our shortcomings. "Yeah, well, if you had seen me try to put my taxes together, you wouldn't say something like that." It's a very natural response when someone comes with this global assessment of who we are and how great we are, that we almost always are very uncomfortable with that. In my example, like, "Your chesed knows no limits." And my first thought is, I'm the most unthoughtful person in the world. I left this person stranded. That's my immediate response. If you globally sum me up and summarize me in this way, I know that that's not true. We all know that when we get summarized in such a manner that it's not really true, and it forces us almost to defend ourselves and to almost prove how it's not true. You see, don't make me live up to this expectation because I'm certainly not like that. This is what we do this to our children all the time. We levy on them the types of praise in which we are actually assessing them or evaluating them as people. We're assessing their personalities. We are stating that they are always so helpful. "You're such a mitzvah boy. You're so good with this." And when we do and say things like that, in which we focus on their character and their personality, it very often has a very opposite impact of what it is that we're trying to accomplish, because we're forcing them to say, "That's not true. I'm not really like that." I think Yitzchak Gena tells a story in his book of a couple that he had been working one of their workshops, and they had been driving back from the vacation they took. They were going from Pittsburgh back to New York. And after about 4 hours in the car, the mother realizes that her six-year-old son has been really an angel the whole trip back. And says to him, "You are such an angel back there." And within 30 seconds, he took one of the ashtrays, this is in the days of smoking in your car, took one of the ashtrays and reached over and dumped it all over his parents' laps. So Chaim Ginat, he said, his workman goes, "So what had happened?" He had actually been fantasizing, as she said that, about his baby brother, who was two, that he really wishes he would just disappear. And the way that they had been situated in the car was that the baby was right in the middle, so the father, mother, and then the six-year-old, and right in the middle of the seat was, so you know, if the car had been jackknifed right through the middle, we'd be able to get rid of the baby, and we'd be, and that's what he'd been thinking about at the time, as six-year-olds are sometimes creative thinkers. And at that moment, his mother says, "You're such an angel." And he was torn as this little kid. "Don't call me an angel. I'm dreaming about figuring a way to get rid of my brother, and you're calling me an angel." And so he had to prove to his parents, you know, "Well, I'm not really as good as you think." So I photocopied it right out of this book. So all the credit right from the How to Talk to some stuff. I love the way that they do the little cartoons. I thought I'd just make a little packet up and you could read through them a little bit for a second as we go through this.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
I'm listening to this discussion and I keep thinking to myself, and I mean, maybe we're not at that stage yet with our kids, but like, I don't think our kids react to the praise in that negative, like I don't see the negative reaction towards the praise. I actually see it, I mean if I say to Jordan, he does something good and I say, wow, you're such a mitzvah boy, like he then says, now I'm going to go help you do this. Like he likes
that kind of
praise. Right, he says, can you write me a mitzvah note? Will you put this in my mitzvah note? Or, you know, then I'll say to him, can you go get Kayla's diaper? And he'll say, yeah, Mom, sure I can. I'm a mitzvah boy. Like, and he's enjoying the positive praise.
I think that is great that he's at that stage. I don't know that it will last where when the child's praise, the theory that they are working with, the first page of this is the descriptive praise on your front cover. It's double-sided. The problem that he's trying to work through is that when the praise that we give is where us as the parents are evaluating the children, we are telling them what their worth is, and it's not that they're figuring that on their own. They become dependent on our praise to define who they are and their self-worth because we're the ones who are telling them. You're telling him he's a mitzvah boy as opposed to him figuring that out on his own, that these are the things that I'm able to do. So it might be that right now he is reacting positively to it, but in the long run, what we're going to work on, or just work through, I don't know if you've seen these cartoons before, if you've seen from the book, the idea of being able to actually describe what you see as opposed to is a very difficult task. I personally struggle with this all the time because it's so much easier to just evaluate and say, that's fantastic. But just looking at this first page, we'll just start with this first page here for now. So instead of evaluating, so in other words, the three examples that they have here is, you know, the girl cleans up a room, so you clean, what a good girl you are. So a common thought that she would have is something along the lines of, well, you know, I put stuff under the bed, cut corners, and the idea that we want to do is describe both what we see or what we feel in terms of getting into the praise. I have experienced this from the times that I've been able to do this. It's a totally different reaction from the child in which they hear they hear us describing what it is that they did. So in which you could describe the way that the child put it away, describe what a pleasure it is for me. Oh, this is such a pleasure to walk into your room after you've done this. I'm just describing what I see, what I feel based on what it is that you've done. The second example is one that I personally love. Both of them, you know, the girl makes a scarf for her dad, or the boy writes a poem. And so when we are always faced with this, the child brings us a drawing that they did in school. And the initial reaction is, oh, it's so wonderful, it's so amazing, it's so great. Now, the problem that I always have with this is, you know, I happen to do a lot of speaking as part of an occupational hazard that I have. When I hear someone say, that was a real nice job, that means absolutely nothing. Like, that's usually at my son, like, oh, whatever, so-so, or they don't want to say anything bad, but they really have a negative comment to say, but they don't want to say it, they want to be nice to me, so we'll just say something plain. There's no way of really knowing what a person felt about something when you just use a generic great, fantastic, wonderful, lovely, amazing, I love it. It doesn't tell me anything about what I did. And the true value of praise that we're really trying to give to our children is which we praise their efforts, their accomplishments, as opposed to evaluating the job that they did. We don't want to be in the position of, I'm judging your work, and it will be good when I say it's good. Do you like this? I don't want to be in the position where my child needs to look to me to see whether or not what they did is a good job, and I need to tell, yes, this is good, no, it wasn't good, or it's great. Let me describe what you did. I see a picture with red and with green and with triangles and with circles, and what you will find, and I have seen this in my own kids, I would testify to this, after doing that kind of stuff, the children will then say, I am an artist. I didn't say that. I didn't tell him, oh, you're such an artist. It's so good. He said, wow, look at what I see. I see a red circle over here and the blue line over here and the pink triangle there. And he put all the different colors together and let them come to the conclusion of, I like to draw, or I am an artist. I'm a good builder because of the way that they're able to do that. And they don't evaluate. They on their own come to that conclusion as opposed to us evaluating it. It is really not simple to do. I cannot underestimate or overstate, I should say, how simple it is to simply just flip right back into, yes, it's wonderful, yes, it's amazing, as opposed to really being able to describe what it is that you see. Now, on the second page, which I'm sure you're all looking at already, the summing at the top of the summing it up in a word is a great tool. Now, most of your children are younger, as Marcy was pointing out, but as they get older, these drawings are certainly for older children, but it would apply to as they get older, describe what it is that they did. Put it into words, the type of praise of what it is that they did. You've been working so hard to memorize that vocabulary. That's perseverance. Give them the description, the word of what it is that you're seeing them do, whether or not it's punctuality, taking initiative, or in all the examples that you could read over here. It's a task. It's a difficult task to be able, a skill, to be able to, as children, do things. And we are always, 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 this will happen guaranteed tomorrow 3-4 times with any one of your children, in which you'll be in a position to offer them praise, and being able to offer them praise in a way in which you describe what it is that you're seeing from them and let them draw the conclusions about themselves, as opposed to us evaluating it, being the judge of what it is that they are. Imagine, just to bring the point home, imagine if each one of you as a spouse would hand over to your spouse at the end of the month a report card. And you'd say, dinners this month, that was a B. Hugs, hugging was great, that was an A. Putting the kids to bed, you did all right. I'll give you a B+ on that. None of us would like to be on the receiving end of the things that we did, that they were evaluated, that they were somehow being judged by somebody, even if it's a spouse, forget about by a parent. None of us would like that from our parents. None of us want our parents to come home, spend the Shabbos with us, and then on their way out, hand us a little card and say, well, we were watching how you handled the kids over Shabbos, and we thought, you did, dinner time routine, that was okay, A-. Bath time disaster. C+ on the bath time routine. The way you two guys interacted with each other, I really like that. You showed a lot of improvement from the last time that I was here. We wouldn't stand for that at all. You have to deal with that? I'm sorry. We can talk about that later. But that's not anything that we would appreciate having to deal with. And we would begin to be very uneasy. Very uneasy. If that's what we dealt with when our parents came, and then they came back, let's say 3 Shabbosim later, we're going to be very uneasy walking like that. We're being watched and evaluated, and the things that we're doing are being graded in that way. So the approach that Ginat and Faber Mezlish are positing is that when it comes to, we don't want to be on the evaluating end where we're actually deciding whether or not it was good or was no good. We want to be in the place in which we are spending a lot of time describing not their character, not their personality, describing what it is that they accomplished, what it is that they did, how proud they must feel of themselves, how good you must feel, look at how hard you worked. I see what you did. You picked up all of the toys in only 17 minutes. What an amazing accomplishment that is. But really reflect an accurate measure, a reflection of their accomplishments, as opposed to some distorted image of their personality, which, right, even as a 4-year-old, they don't rebel against. But we know as adults, we don't react well when someone describes us and we know that it's not true. We just know that it's not accurate. We don't respond well to that type of praise. Yeah?
Another thing. I've seen somewhere that we act sometimes like a mirror to a child, we as adults have certain pictures of ourselves, but they may not. So is it helpful sometimes to give them a picture of themselves, their character, whatever?
Yes, by describing what it is that they did. In other words, let's say he's a musician. He's playing the keyboard really well. So instead of saying to your 7-year-old, you're such a good musician, say something along the lines of, I love the music that's in the house. Describe the scene, and describe how hard he's working, how much he's practicing, as opposed to evaluating him as a musician. Just describe how you feel about, I love hearing you play in the house.
If you've done something very kind to his brother or sister, and you want to say, you have such good heart, you have such good...
Right, so but when you say that, he's thinking about all the times that he beat his sister up. Mm-hmm. So describe what he just did. That was so kind. That act that you did was full of good heart. That I feel great about it. I just did something. It was noted and it was appreciated in an accurate way in which my actions were noticed and described, as opposed to not, you told me that I had such a big heart. I don't know if that's always so true. I might be uncomfortable with you telling me that. What if next time I fail? I don't want to live up to that expectation of having a big heart. So just describe the act that I just saw, how you gave up your cookie to your little sister. That was such a nice thing to do. Not that you're such a nice person, that was such a nice act of sharing.
I hope he will get that idea eventually.
He will. In other words, 100%.
Yeah.
say, though, that the kid who's around, at least when he's little, or she's little, to know that they're a good girl, they're good, as opposed to saying, the act that you did is good, what it means. Interpret that to thinking, to knowing that, instead of you outwardly telling them. You know, I was listening to a share from a Kellerman, Kellerman was saying, like, you should call his child little Sadical, Tadical, that was his nickname, Sadical. And so at one point, they went to, you know, in Aristotle, they were going somewhere on a pit stop, and the only bathroom was in a bar, you know, so he's like, oh, but I can't go in there, I'm a Sadic. So, like, if he never called him little Sadical, he may feel like, you know, he may not, it may not be missing from his feelings, set of feelings that he is a Sadic, but it kind of defines you in that way.
Yes, so, that...
That is about you, Vanessa. Yeah.
Well,
he
was
sure
that
he
wanted. I would segue from that right into the next thing that I wanted to talk about, and that is different when you're not responding to a specific thing that the child did. In other words, you're calling the child a little tzaddikol, or I love you, you're so delicious, but it's not because you did something in which I'm now praising now what you did and saying that defines you globally as a person because of what you just did, in which... And it's a constant barrage that you're, in which you're building, you're saying that. I would put in the following context. Where I initially saw this idea that 4 out of 5 comments should be positive, give the child a warm, fuzzy feeling. So the initial book that I saw that wanted to break that up in terms of, let's say, 8 out of 10, whatever the numbers would be. So half of them should be statements of conditional love, and half of them statements of unconditional love. Meaning, half of them should be in the positive interactions that we have, half should be in response to something that the child did. Child or son, and you shouldn't give them the praise. You should acknowledge them. You should note whatever it was that was done. But you don't want to only praise the child and say good things about the child when they've done something good, because then you teach the child that their self-worth is really only when they've done something. They never hear anything positive from you unless they've done something good to earn it. So the other half you want it to be just unconditional, not in response to anything that they've done. You just want them to hear from you how special they are to you. You don't want to only do that, because then they think that they can do whatever in the world they want and there are no rules and regulations. But if you mix the two, so then you have that nice balance. So in that 50% of our positive comments, it's just unconditional, it's coming out of nowhere. So it's worthwhile to begin to get the phrases into your head. I'll just share with you the things that I've picked up on from either from others or just made up on my own that is regularly said, you know, around the house, is I will regularly ask my children, you know, just when there's you're walking there, we have nothing really to say, so I'll just throw out the same questions over and over again of, you know, how is it possible that you're cuter today than you were yesterday? How is it possible? How did Hashem do that, that you're cuter today than you were yesterday? And they eventually roll their eyes already, but it's they have that impression that they hear that regularly. Well, I mentioned from the first week, in which they regularly hear each one, like, what are the 5 greatest presents that I've ever got? And they'll list off the children. That's the language that they know is that they are viewed by us as our greatest gifts that they ever have. You know, can you answer me? Can you explain to me, please, how I can love you so much? I don't understand. How is it possible that I can love you? How are you so delicious? And they try to come up with answers. Because I'm so cute. Because and at each age they have different responses, but it's a regular conversation that they roll their eyes already, but it's I don't mind that they roll their eyes on that. They need to hear that regularly, that they are delicious, they are cute, they are cuter today than they were yesterday. Because when you say those things when you're not stressed out, you'll have what to pull out of the bank account when you are. But and that's that same idea in which that's not a response to anything. It's just in the middle of the, out of the blue, tucking them in, just asking them, how is it possible that Hashem made you so cute? How did he do it? How did he make you so cute? So I know that it works, because when one of my sons wanted to stay up for an extra 10 minutes or something, they were playing around the play, and it was bedtime, and I said, oh, 10 more minutes, sorry, it's bedtime, I got a bit of bed. Oh, come on, because we're so cute. And when they already start playing that back, as the reason why they should get some stuff, to me that's a total victory. That's great. That they feel that they should use their cuteness, how much we love them, how delicious they are, in their favor, that means they've gotten the message. They might roll their eyes like, don't, you asked me that yesterday, Dad. I don't care. Because it's part of their makeup now that they know they're special, that we love them just because they're ours, they're a gift, they're a presence, they're cuter today than they were yesterday. And that's how I would respond to that. But when they've done something specific and I want to praise them, then I don't want to globalize them and say, wow, you're such a tzaddik, you just gave up your ice cream, you just shared your ice cream with your sister. Because then I get into, I don't want to evaluate him as a person because he's done something. I want him to know that in general I think of him that way, but not in response to anything like that. That's how I would respond to that.
Can I guess which kid?
Yes.
Fine.
Nope. Oh. Nope. Yeah. That's okay.
What?
That was Binyamin. Binyamin made that argument. That was the Binyamin argument. But,
it'll be fine soon.
Soon. And I hope so. And it should be that way, that they get that sense, they hear that regularly, that they are a gift, that they're a present, that they're cute and delicious. Okay, let me do one last thing for this evening. So Chaim Dina entitles one of his chapters, Fish Swim, Birds Fly, and People Feel. They just do. We all have feelings. We can't stop them. It's part of the human condition. That we have them. Now, guys will generally try to not deal with them as well or as much as the gals, but they're there nonetheless, and they're there in children. There's nothing that we can do about it. It's just a reality in children's lives that they're going to have to deal with their feelings. They're going to get frustrated. They're going to be angry. They're going to be disappointed. They're going to be jealous. They're going to be embarrassed. They're going to be scared. They have all of those emotions that they go through. Now, we have a tough time dealing with that. Let's just couple of examples just to start. How do we respond to that? Let's just say you had a birthday party for your four-year-old yesterday. Let's just say. And you went all out. You hired a fancy company to come and run a whole program and a cake and the food, and you have to do all of this stuff. You get back after 3 hours of the cleaning and you are exhausted. And you're exhausted and sunk. You sit down on the couch and you say, my four-year-old, wasn't that awesome? And he says, that was a dumb party. What's your initial reaction?
You've got to be kidding me.
Something along those lines, right? Well, most of us would say something along the lines of,
are you kidding?
How ungrateful are you?
So, how ungrateful are you? I'm never doing this again. You're gonna, or, no, it wasn't. It was so much fun. We did, and then you list off all of the fun things that you did.
What about this? What about that?
That's one of the things I do. What about if you're having you're all excited, your in-laws or your parents are coming, you better if it's your own parents. Parents are coming to visit. And you say to your six-year-old, guess who's coming tonight? Who's coming? Bubby's coming. I hate Bubby. What's your reaction? Right. Bubby, of course you love your Bubby. No, you can't.
You always have so much fun.
Right. That's how we react. That's our knee-jerk response every single time. You're having company and you tell your five-year-old who's coming, and it's like, ugh, I hate that person. She's so mean. No, she's not. Or that's just how we regularly respond. And if you listen to the way that we deal with our children, we are regularly denying their feelings. It's hot in here. No, it's not. It's very nice. I don't want to wear my sweater. I'm not cold. It's cold outside. You have to wear your sweater. Right. You do like broccoli. You like ice cream. We very regularly get into a habit of whatever it is that they say when we feel it's either inappropriate or we flat out disagree with them, right? We know better. It's not cold, right? It's not hot. You do love your boogie, and I said so. So we get into that. The habit, children have feelings. They do. They feel certain ways. They express themselves because they don't have the inhibitions. And we do a very good job of pounding them down and teaching them that they really shouldn't trust their feelings, or that they're not allowed to have those feelings, and that we are going to tell them we are going to tell them how they should feel and when they should feel. This is the most natural thing. Even if I've read this stuff many times and will catch myself all the time doing this, it's a regular knee-jerk reaction, especially again with the things that we're like offended by. Like, what do you mean you hate your booby? You can't hate your booby. You can't hate your baby brother. You, and it's right. You need to be 35 before you can hate booby. let me tell you about hating booby. But so that's just as an example, yesterday it rained. So three things happened because of the rain. Number one, the Braves game was canceled. rain out. The JCC had their big Israel festival that was a total flop because of the fact that it was rained out and had to be moved inside, and about a tenth of the people that were supposed to be there came just because of the circumstances. And I'm sure there was a birthday party somewhere that was canceled because it was supposed to be outside and couldn't be moved. Now, probably none of us care personally about all three of those events. We might not care about any of them. We might care about one or two of them. But let's just say you were planning your whole family trip to going to the Braves game, and you had planned the whole vacation because you live down in wherever you live, Georgia, and you made a whole big deal about it, and you packed up your picnic, and you travel all the way down there, and then the game is canceled. Well, that's going to be a pretty big disappointment. And if you were the one who planned the big event yesterday at the JCC, now, most of us probably were just, we were going to go, and so half of us went because of the rain, but if you were one of the organizers, and it rained, and you had to deal with the mess of now moving it all inside, and most of the people not coming, and I got all this food and all the vendors, that's going to be a huge disappointment. And if you're a kid, and you're supposed to have a birthday party, and it was canceled, or it wasn't done in the way that it was supposed to be done, you're going to be just as disappointed as either one of those other two events, even though when we look at that as adults, our immediate reaction is, ah, come on, what's the big deal? We'll do it next week. Or we'll do something instead. Instead of, in the same way as adults, if we're on the receiving end of that, that's very disappointing. So it is for our children also. Shlomo Volder Zatzal writes that when you take away a toy wooden boat from a child in his bathtub without warning him, without telling him, just take it away from him, that is the exact same experience for him as if you had an ocean liner that you owned and it just sunk in the sea. And someone would look at it and say, God would say, what's the big deal? It's just $1 million or $2. Like, so what? It's just gone. $1 million. This is my ocean liner. But that's what it is. So I could say, what's the big deal? So what? I don't have an ocean liner and I don't care. And maybe the guy's got another $5 million in the bank. But for the person who owned it, who lost it, that's a big deal. When you take away that little boat from the kid, in his world, it's the exact same experience. And learning to appreciate the reality of that is critical to allowing the child to develop that, especially as children. They don't have names or words for the experiences that they're going through. They don't understand the difference of what it means to be angry or disappointed or frustrated or jealous. And it's our job to teach them as to what that experience is like, allow them to experience it, because they are allowed to. That's what happens as a 4-year-old and a 5-year-old and a 6-year-old, and help them deal with it as opposed to constantly pushing it aside. You don't hate Bobby, really, you love Bobby. The child's thinking, no, I really hate Bobby, but now I'm not sure what to make of the fact that I'm experiencing this and my parents are telling me that really I love Bobby. But I don't love Bobby. But they tell me, I'm cold. No, you're hot. No, I'm cold. No, but it's hot outside. Well, what am I supposed to make of that when I can't make those very simple decisions of, I'm tired. What do you mean you're tired? You just woke up from your nap. But I'm tired. But I'm not, no, you can't, you're not tired. Go do something else. Or I'm hungry. All those things in terms of that. So there are, so the last two pages are both double-sided. So there are four things. So let's just go through these and we'll try these out at home during the week. Now, things really get, it's out of order. So the first one is listen with full attention, which is an obvious one. I don't want to spend too much attention on that one. That's obvious. As parents, I photocopied it anyway, just because even though we all know this one, if you'll pay attention to how many times we don't pay attention to our children as they're speaking to us, we have to pay attention, and then sometimes, I can't even count how many times just people say to me, your daughter's talking to you? Did you notice that? Because you actually started talking to her, and then you got distracted with something else, and she's still speaking, but you're not listening anymore. And it's good to have somebody who points that out to you, but very often, if you do that enough, the children, they pick up that we are not listening at all. So it's worth photocopying. You'll have a little touch here. Number two is actually on the very back page, acknowledging with a word. So this is a skill in which we have. So they say, instead of questions and advice. So very often what happens is the little girl comes in and says, somebody stole my new pencil. So we as parents right away launch in with all sorts of questions. We're going to interrogate what happened. We'll give advice. I sure didn't lose it. I didn't. Well, and then we give the mother launches into this whole thing of what do you expect to happen if you leave your things lying around. She gives her a whole speech. And then the daughter basically says, well, she's not really very interested in this. So there's a tool of simply, as the adult, as the parent, let the child be acknowledged. Let her play it out. somebody stole my new red pencil. That doesn't require you to start interrogating. You don't need to, you're not the, you know, the VA who's going to figure out, well, we're not, let it go. Oh. And then let her explain, let it out, and this is a, now obviously, it doesn't work out as nicely as these cartoons every single time. That goes without saying. But as it writes on the, as they write on the bottom, it's very hard for a child to think clearly or constructively when someone is questioning, blaming, or advising her. That's the main point, that when something happens and a child comes in with something, now this is where the reason why I like to say this, and I'd love to introduce these books together with Love and Logic. This isn't going, Love and Logic isn't necessarily, I mean, this is a very different approach. A child comes in and says, my pencil was stolen today. If you're in your Love and Logic mode,
what are we going to do about that?
Right, you just shift into a whole different approach of, well, you know, that's what happened, and let the child learn. So this is coming from a different angle of the communication response of how to draw the child out, let the child speak, let the child be heard. We're not necessarily interested in teaching a lesson. This is just having a communication with my child, having a conversation in which I'm not going to launch into accusations. I'm not going to blame. I'm not going to interrogate to find out what happened. Let the child think it through. Let's just go through the third and the fourth ones, which are also just... So the third thing is, you know, give the feeling a name. This, I remember seeing the first time I saw this cartoon. This was just one of my all-time favorites. If you haven't yet read this one with the dead turtle, right? Little girl comes home and the turtle is dead. So father says, right, denying the feeling, child is suffering a trauma. Now we as the adults say, what's the big deal? It's just a little turtle. And so we often would start that conversation. Oh, it's just a goldfish. Or it's just a turtle.
How come I'm the only one that ever eats?
Cookie break? I'm passing around. Okay.
Fire.
So the conversation would generally follow the pattern where, you know, the parent tries to teach the child, no, don't bother crying, it's not such a big deal, and, you know, I'll buy you another one. But none of those are addressing the actual feelings, the emotions that the child is going through. Now, it is very hard to actually play the role of the parent in this situation. It does not come natural to us, in which you see, you know, the child comes home and the goldfish is swimming in the top of the water, to be able to give that feeling in it. My turtle is dead. He was alive this morning. That's such a shock. Like, he thought this and he came home and to express that. He was my friend. It hurts to lose a friend. That's very hard. Talking to you, you had fun, you really cared. The parent doesn't solve the problem. There actually is no problem that can be solved. The turtle is dead. There's nothing that the parent can do about it. It's going to be a painful situation. The child doesn't know how to deal with that. There's a loss that just took place in this little child's life, and we're very good at denying it, at convincing the child that it's not really a big deal, as opposed to actually acknowledging the fact that the child is going through that. And this is where I personally have the same problem as in the Love and Logic, where there's a level of empathy that you actually need to really have when you go through this exercise. The child comes on, the turtle is dead, and it's very easy to be sort of, you know, like, but to actually be able to say, oh, that's so disappointing, or that must be so frustrating, or that's so sad. To be able to do that is very hard, but it's really the only thing that the child wants to hear, because the children are just like us. They're going through something, and the child is actually worse than us as adults, because we as adults can sometimes put words to the feelings we're going through, and we want somebody to empathize. The child is often just more confused. They don't know what to do with what it is that they're going through. It's much more hard without those words, and for the parents to be able to play that role and to be able to say, that's so disappointing, it's really hard. When their toy breaks, and the child comes running in, and their toy is broken, to be able to express, that's so upsetting, that's so frustrating, that's so disappointing. you know, love and logicking would be just, you know, again, those are, we're taking a different kind of approach of, you know, what are we going to do about that? There's no solving the problem. I just want to get into the world of my child who is suffering through on her 5, 6, 7, 8, whatever age level that it is that they're going through, and be able to empathize and get into the world of the child and be able to describe the experience that they have. That's one of our primary jobs, is to teach our children the vocabulary of the emotions that they're going through. Very, very difficult if you've ever tried it before. I struggle with it till today myself. But this is an exercise in putting children to bed and seeing how well it works. As you can hear, it is not very successful.
So, yeah. Can I ask a question? Because now I felt like I was like on a certain track over the last couple of weeks. And I know that you're saying that you like these two approaches together. How, like, if we've just now started using the love and logic and putting that sort of, and like, you know, Jordan's starting to get it,
because
this is very much more what we naturally do. And so now I'm a bit confused as to how do I put these together, because they are so different. And how do I put them together without seeming inconsistent to the child, because I'm now...
So I personally love love and logic as a behavioral model in response to the child, in the sense of the child is either misbehaved or not followed a rule direction in the house, that there's a consequence to it. Real life often has experiences where the child did nothing wrong. The child just... It's turtle died. So I'm not interested in teaching a child a consequence. There's no consequence. Life happens. Life is difficult. Life is sometimes painful or hard. I want to be there with my child as he or she goes through it, in terms of the everyday communications. And the reality is, this is where every parent couple sort of finds their own way as to, you know, what works. That there's... If, you know, if you read this and say, you know, this really isn't for me, I'm good with love and logic, that works for me, I'm happy, then that's fine. But like when some of the questions, you know, like, it's a little bit harsh, I'm not really feeling a lot of loving communication. When the two go together, you know, your everyday experiences can, and sometimes, you know, a lot of times that's not, love and logic is like a whole, sometimes you're just not, you're not there. Not every moment is going to be this massive teaching. Just for example, like, let's just do the last page, just to round this out. If you haven't read it yet, so there's no more cereal left in the house. For the last page, number 4. Right, instead of an explanation or logic, right, you can get into an arguing match. Right, I want my Toasty Crunchies. Right? Well, we don't have any left. But I want them. Well, I just told you that there aren't any left. So then you could offer something else, and then you get into a whole... Right, that's not a... We've all been there. That doesn't really work very well.
Mm-hmm.
So let the child play out his wishes in fantasy. This sometimes is a great tool to use. Right? And with some others, and says, wow, I wish I had the ability to give it to you. And you could sort of sit in that moment. You give the child his wish in make-believe and fantasy. Well, I wish I could do this, this, or the other. I wish that we could go here, here, and there. And just let the conversation go out. And then, you know, the child often will be able to then redirect themselves because you haven't engaged in a battle. Now, what would love and logic, like there's a classic example, right? Love and logic, you get into the kitchen, there's no food. Right? The child doesn't have the cereal that the child wants. I want my Toasty Krispies. So I'm sorry, we don't have any. But I want it. So you just be like, so I'm not going to engage in a battle, so you just get into like, I guess you do something. Like, I know you want them, I know. But that's just not engaging in a battle. That's not getting there. And that's an approach that just says, I'm not going to engage in
it. Neutral versus a positive.
Right. So that would just neutralize us. So sometimes it's just, we just need to neutralize it. I'm not going to engage. I'm just going to, as opposed to trying to empathize and try to get into the world of the child as to what it's like. Like, I know, I wish I could give it to you. Or that must be so frustrating when you really want it. And which, that's a much more active engagement than a lot of love and logic techniques, which are really just that behavior modification. Getting into that pattern of describing with that, I really want that too. I know that's so frustrating when what you want, we don't have anything. We don't have anything more of what you want. That happens all the time, and it's so frustrating. I really wish that I had them for you. It's you find your way, sort of which scenarios really work the best for when they are. And I don't have a better response than that, other than the fact that there are these different tools. Love and logic, to me, doesn't address this aspect of the children's feelings. Kids have feelings. They get frustrated. As your children will get older, they will regularly come home with, a double booking, in which they had wanted to go out with this friend, and then they found out there's something else going on. And they don't know how to handle that. They want to do both things at once. And they'll literally, I guarantee this will happen in every single one of your homes, because it's just, that's part of normal. They'll just literally break down and have a fit because there are too many things going on. They don't know where to go, what to do. And they need to be told and taught that's so confusing, or you're so conflicted, or whatever language that they're up to, where you really want to do two things at the same time and you can't do both. There's not a love and logic moment there. It's just a matter of I understand what it is that you're going through, that it's sometimes hard. You really want to do two things at the same time and you can't do that, and you have to sort of make that decision. Mommy finds it very hard also when I really want to do those kinds of things. And it's really just being able to appreciate their feeling, to listen, to be able to acknowledge it, let them speak it out. I see. Oh, that must be so tough. That's so frustrating. Give the words to the feelings that they are going through. All right. So in summary, I just wanted to go. So tonight we just did is working through three tools to try to either neutralize or even make positive some of the regular interactions that we have, which otherwise are often very, very stressful. That in terms of trying to get the word no out of our vocabulary as much as possible, being able to tell the child instead of saying no, telling them when they can have it, what they need to do in order to be able to get it, what are the circumstances where, and letting them have their own the choices as we prepare them to be able to do that. To working on praise, working on describing the activity that we see when your kid comes home from their kindergarten play, whatever it is, and so saying, that was great, you were a fantastic actor, actually be able to describe what it is that they did. How you memorized all of your lines and you stood up there with such confidence, it was so much fun for me to see you up there. Being able to describe your feelings towards it and describe what it is that they did is a task. You can get started on that right away, you'll have plenty of opportunities for that. And being able to begin to pay attention to the feelings that our children express to us, and not immediately denying them with what it is that we want them to feel and to have, and to be able to acknowledge and to state what it is that they have, and then using some of these tools of either giving the child his wishes in his own fantasy world, or pretending that it's there, or just describing it, acknowledging it with a word, giving them the attention that they need to be able to acknowledge what it is that they're going through. That creates that loving bond in which we are there and in touch together with our children. So I look forward to hearing some reports back next week as to how any of this goes.